Well, hey, welcome everybody. As you know, this is our final seminar, and I've mentioned that we can stay a bit longer after the top of the hour for discussion, for question and answer. You probably saw my email with a couple of prompts, my questions to consider for discussion. If you have any response right now, I would welcome that. You can save it, think about it. What's the single most important thing at this point that you're taking away from this series for you, for your practice? What might you do differently based on what you've gleaned from this series and its application, hopefully, to what you do? And then also, is there more or different that you would have liked to have seen included or developed further? Any thoughts about that right now? Any responses to that or any clarifications or questions from the previous seminars that might be helpful to discuss before we launch into the final material? So does that mean everything's crystal clear so far? Unlikely with me that that's the case, but anything that would be helpful to talk about as we get ready to move into the final seminar? Questions, clarifications? Anybody want to venture about what's the one thing that you're taking away that's important to you from what we've talked about that may be new or different? Well, think about it. We'll add some time.
Hello, Dave.
Yes, please. Oh, good. I was getting so lonely there.
Hi.
Go ahead. Yes. This is who?
This is Carol. I don't want to get too terribly lonely.
I appreciate that.
I'm working with a client, and really the purpose of the coaching engagement is optimal performance, and is that okay to talk about that topical?
Sure, sure.
Okay, yeah. So anyway, she just re-upped, so this is our second coaching engagement. And I thought we made some really good progress. I say we, but I thought she made some really good progress. And so now, she wants to focus on, overcoming her fears, but a lot of her fears are tied up with what is happening in the present environment, and I'm getting some pushback, and I want to be respectful of that, but I'm getting some pushback from sort of looking at the whole picture. She just wants to focus only on the performance. Have you ever run across something like that in a coaching engagement, and then in what, how did you respond to it? What did you do? Because I'm trying to respect, when my clients say, I don't want to talk about that, I respect that, right? You try to honor it, but part of part of the performance is linked to the other people around the individual. So she can't really, she can have personal success, but her personal success is tied to the collaborative process that takes place.
Okay. Can you say in one phrase what she's pushing back to, what that pushback is about?
She doesn't want to deal with anyone else. She doesn't want to deal with the ancillary, or in her view, the ancillary.
I'm with her. If you're going to help her, she's the only one that she can determine what she does. She's the only one in her entire orbit that she can be effective in determining. So that's exactly what I would look at. Not all the other people, but to help her create a system. If she wants to change and wants to engage peak performance, then help her look at creating a system to do that. And the system begins with where she is right now, to create a map of where she is, where she wants to go, how to measure progress along the way, and how to optimize that performance in terms of her entire input, from mindset to the focus and framing. Like if she, here's where you can come in. If she talks about overcoming a fear, reframe it, because looking at the fear, understanding it, going back into it is not going to help. It's going to etch it further in her brain. Interrupt her and look at what's the possibility here. When you look at an opportunity, at what's next, at something that she can do that can be effective, that's a framing that's going to be useful for her for an immediate performance and mostly for an immediate effectiveness. That's the most basic desire that we have as human beings, to be effective. I've seen infant observational studies of normal kids as early as 3 months of age. They have an effectance pleasure, a pleasure at being a cause. That is exactly why we do something, and that's embellished by the main reason that we do something is how we imagine we're going to feel when we do it. So that's useful to think about, too, at some point. But you and she will both know exactly how she feels when she looks at the next step and does it and creates a system that ultimately she won't need you around because she's internalized that model. That's identity.
Correct.
The best thing
I couldn't agree with you more. I couldn't agree with you more. You're absolutely right about that. But what happens is when she talks, you know, she starts talking about, you know, her, and then she shifts in the conversation and it goes back to those people that she's around.
Okay, let's do this, Carol. How about we do a little psychodrama at the top of the hour after the seminar when we have a little bit more time, and if you can focus just on a sentence or two that she would say, I'll be you and you be her, and we'll look at that.
Great.
in live time. How would that
okay.
work?
Okay, that sounds perfect.
That's a deal. Okay, so thanks for that input, and that's a very important question, and in some form or another is ubiquitous because we are designed to resist change, to keep doing the same thing we've hardwired ourselves to do. And that's, you know, we've talked about that in terms of peak performance, that practice doesn't make perfect, practice makes permanent. So only perfect practice makes perfect performance. So that's what we want to do, is to help someone tolerate the discomfort of change in order to get to a better place. So great. We will definitely come back to that. Any other clarifications or questions before we move into our material? Okay, well, I'm going to put us on lecture mode, and we'll be back to discussion mode in just a bit. Okay, I want to talk in our final seminar about some extreme success challenges. This is something, as I mentioned, I don't think is quite talked about enough in coaching, and something that I think can be beneficial to look at in terms of exceptional achievement and overconfidence, in a sense. So, an example. You ask any player in a physician's basketball league whether he or she would compete with LeBron James. They would laugh. Yet many of those same physicians willingly compete with a billionaire investor, Warren Buffett. Cognitive biases and mental errors make them believe they can outperform or at least parallel successful full-time investment experts. Those who have achieved in exceptional ways create challenges for themselves also in the very attainment of that success. Some highly successful individuals, from expert actors and athletes to practicing medical and legal experts, began to believe they can be good in other areas, like investing. Expertise in one area, though, doesn't equate with expertise in another. Even Warren Buffett recognized this about himself. He said, you know, I don't think being able to allocate capital means you're good at anything else. Overconfidence creates a misperception of ability when it's informed by spectacular success in one area. University of Pennsylvania psychologists Philip Tetlock and Barbara Meller studied over 25,000 forecasts from people whose task was to anticipate how the future would unfold. Their studies, like a number of others, have revealed exceptional overconfidence in the judgments of doctors, lawyers, engineers, even scientists in their decision-making process. The stimulation of overconfidence can be biologically habituating. Look at the recent revelations of politicians, actors, athletes who came to believe their success made them immune, for example, to boundary violations. From Macbeth, we learn that we're most vulnerable, not when we're beginning, not even when we're destitute or needy, but after the biggest triumphs of our lives. We're on tilt, perhaps, at those times. For Macbeth, the moment the witches came was after the most massive successes he had ever experienced, winning 2 battles, and was immensely popular. Just look at Elvis, Marilyn, Janice, F. Scott, Kurt, Belushi, Philip Seymour Hoffman. Some people need mentor coaches not to become successful, but to help them regulate their states of mind, manage emotions, and to sustain success. Complacency and overconfidence can be equal challenges. Navigating extreme success creates unique challenges. And I think this is something that we need to talk about more in mentor coaching, especially as your clients get more remarkably successful, they may not have a model for that any more than the athlete who's been remarkably successful has a model for financial success when they go from 0 to 60 million in 10 seconds. Exceptional success transcends usual and expectable categories. It also occurs when accomplishments or the resultant fame or wealth transcend any possible anticipation, preparation, or model of engaging it. Here's the very scientific way that this was once put. This is from Keith Richards. He said, "Fame has killed more very talented guys than drugs." Now, there's another phenomenon that's so common, yet often surprising because it's hard to anticipate and prepare for. Here's an example. After Bruce Jenner's last decathlon in Montreal, he spent decades doing this. The next morning he said, "What am I going to do now?" Success anticlimax occurs after the completion of a long-practiced and anticipated event, and this can go, as for him, decades. The excitement, preparation, and anticipation are all mediated by dopamine, the pleasure chemical released by anticipatory excitement. This sprint system of dopamine shifts when the event's over, though. And the marathon neurochemical system of norepinephrine designed to maintain and sustain endeavors takes over. And the experience is really different. It reads differently. This shift can read as a lack of excitement, as if something were missing, which of course it is compared to the anticipatory stimulation of dopamine, even perceived as feeling slightly depressed by comparison. Robert Louis Stevenson said it simply, "To travel hopefully is a better thing than to arrive." The athletes and executives I've worked with and others I've interviewed have learned to contend with the anticlimax of shifting from stimulating anticipation to sustaining maintenance and to dose anticipation in an effective way. We'll talk more about that. I vividly recall my favorite athletic coach's first introduction to me of this version, his version of this aspect of sports psychology. As a freshman, I was fortunate to make the traveling squad of 12 players in basketball, even though I felt intimidated by the upperclassmen surrounding me. Just after we won our first tournament and we boarded our team bus, coach stood at the front of the bus and looked at each of us. We were all feeling really good at the big win and eager to get home and celebrate with a parade downtown. He said, "So, we won this tournament. This is not the biggest or the most prestigious tournament that we'll play. In fact, it's kind of a podunk tournament." He paused. "How many of you can really say you're proud to win this tournament?" Now, under any circumstance, I'd have shot my hand in the air. And I suspect each of my teammates will, but nobody dared venture a single finger in the air. His conclusion, feel good for now, but let's get home and really start working on being an excellent team. Coach knew how to handle success anticlimax, to ladder success, to look at what's next, and the growth mindset in that framework of doing and being even better. His life-changing coaching and the mentoring of me for 4 years in three sports resulted in many wins, some championships, but mostly to my sequential careers of helping others succeed in psychiatry and then in mentor coaching. For any physical or intellectual achievement, the emotional and creative closure have to be addressed upon a successful completion. I've known authors, for example, who describe a letdown after completion of their book. One even described it as a postpartum depression. And that was a guy. The most successful achievers have evolved their strategies to ladder success and plan for transition. So let's look at this from a different perspective. Does proven evidence change beliefs? We usually are inclined to try to give information to convince somebody of something. Facts and belief are anatomical realities in our brain. You do not create a change in somebody else's brain by introducing a new idea or belief and expect it to overwrite the one that's already there. Many of you have heard me say, if information was enough, we'd all exercise every day, eat mostly vegetables, be thin, have a lot of money saved up for the future, and a lot of librarians would be billionaires. Facts and logic are not powerful tools to alter opinions. Data is not a way to change minds. It simply is not how we decide. Established beliefs are extremely resistant to change, even if scientific efforts disprove those beliefs. In fact, proven evidence can backfire. Here's how. People regard information as valid evidence when it reinforces their existing views. So presenting someone with information that contradicts an opinion or belief that they already have most often results in that person generating new counterarguments to further strengthen their view, because their view is part of their identity. It's called the boomerang effect. This is how arguments more staunchly solidify an original position. In fact, the brighter and more intellectually flexible someone is, the more inclined they are to find ways to establish and validate their own belief. That's where the boomerang effect idea came from. So people grow more confident in their initial convictions and use information to polarize opinions. Think about examples. Abortion, gun control, climate change. Have you ever changed anybody's mind by arguing your position? We quickly accept evidence that confirms our preconceived notions, and we assess counter evidence with a critical, even disbelieving idea. Then we cherry pick information to fortify our beliefs, perhaps without even consciously being aware of it, and give selective inattention to what invalidates our position. People use their intelligence not to examine data to draw more accurate conclusions, but to find fault in data they already disbelieve. Think about your last discussion with your partner, if you have any doubt about that. The mind's desire for continuity and certainty, coupled with activating the brain's error detection mechanism if there's new or unsuspected information that doesn't fit with what you believe, both contribute to the continuity of belief and action. Now, a success trap in business is an almost ubiquitous developmental phenomenon in which a company must shift and evolve in a way it operates in order to survive. Think about if this has ever happened, for example, with your coaching practice. An example is Kodak. Stuck to analog photography, did not evolve to digital. More recently, Andy Grove at Intel described the success trap at being as being a time in an organization's life when the leaders have to think differently from only developing and refining what's already successfully in place to think creatively of what can be. Grove said, miss the moment and you start to decline. He noted the difficulty at Intel to move on from memory chips to embrace the next technology of microprocessing in order to sustain the viability of the entire company. This was his self-reflection of his own mistake, as he talked about openly. Successful performance for an individual or company can sustain focus on what created the success rather than looking to the next success. In fact, the new success becomes the old success unless there's a new model to move into. Attention to execution of the current success may miss the innovation that's needed to take the new and next steps forward. This is deliberate practice applied to the system of a team, a business, or a practice. Brain scans, for example, of 63 seasoned business decision makers showed two things. Moving to new territory of exploratory strategies disengages from the pleasing routine of certainty. To leave the default mode to attend to new possibilities is uncomfortable and takes more energy. Yet at the same time, creative innovation stimulates brain circuitry of anticipation and reward. This is what happens in every client you have, are, and will work with. There is a discomfort in moving into something new or different, or even considering something new or different from what they're familiar with. Now, there are some specific biases that are created or exaggerated by success that can have an impact on performance. I want to just highlight a couple of the more evident ones. Awareness of the tendency to these biases to influence decisions and maybe even dilute optimum performance becomes important to recognize. So here are just some of the more common performance-based biases and a quick look at their remedies. One is self-deceptions. These have been distilled from a number of studies. Self-inflation, especially at times of significant success. 94% of people place themselves at the top half of their profession. 70% of both men and women feel they're better looking than average. 19% of people believe they're in the top 1% of income. 70% of drivers believe they're better than average. Yeah, I know that's not true, at least here in Texas. 75% of people consider themselves healthier than average. Another, derogation of others. The shadow story of self-inflation occurs when an image has been tarnished or when there's a need to align with the in-group, to degrade the outgoing, or to align with the powerful. The Stockholm Syndrome, as it was first described 40 years earlier in psychoanalysis, identification with the aggressor. Another, moral superiority. Naturally, the referees are right when they call a foul on the visiting team, but their worst mistake is to call a foul on my favorite home team. If the Houston Rockets, at least prior to this season, if I ever moved to Dallas, it would instantly become my favorite Maverick, and the Rockets would be out of favor. Or the illusion of control. When we feel a lack of control, it enhances our tendency to see meaningful patterns in otherwise random data, because this gives us a false sense of effectiveness. Speaking of conspiracy theories. Invincibility bias. Here are some common examples. Adolescents may tend to estimate danger poorly and to exaggerate anticipated performance. So they may engage in risky behavior. Heavy smokers underestimate their cancer risk despite objective awareness of danger. Skiers ignore warning signs and enter restricted areas to ski dangerous terrain, sometimes to their peril. Or someone sees a roulette wheel stop on red 6 times in a row and believe their chances are higher the next time that it's going to stop on black. 100% of those who believe the roulette wheel has a memory will abandon those, the 50-50 red-black possibility, and some will win their next bet and be right for the wrong reason. Another example, optimism bias. Our tendency to overestimate the possibility of bad events in our lives and to underestimate the possibility of bad events and to overestimate the possibility of good events. We underestimate the likelihood of a car accident, for example, of having cancer, and overestimate our life expectancy and future income. Newlyweds estimate the likelihood of divorce at almost 0%, though statistically it's somewhere between 40 and 50. There are a number of examples in your outline. Hindsight bias, subjectivity bias, present bias. Here's one that I want to highlight because it's something that we may have more of an approach to in coaching for certain clients. Transparency bias. When we perceive fairness, we experience a rewarding good feeling. When we perceive unfairness, this triggers our reptilian brain that mediates the perception of threat and survival with its own neurochemical system. Fairness is a keystone in both collaboration and leadership, but it can be overridden by a sense of unfairness to interfere with creativity, motivation, and teamwork. Now, in some very recent studies, a major factor in the perception of fairness is transparency. The effort we perceive that goes into a task or an item, we often use the amount of effort we actually see as a shortcut to the perception of value. When something takes little time or looks easy, or when the work itself is not visible, not transparent to the recipient, significant reaction occurs. An example is an attorney charging $500 for an hour for work that's not transparent. Here's another more common example. If two people who live together are put in separate rooms and each is asked the amount of housework the other does, the combined figure is almost always over 100%. There's a transparency asymmetry. Each is aware of his or her own work, but unaware of the extent of the work of the other. We value and we perceive more accurately what's transparent. Another, and I'll just highlight some of the, one more common one, is projection bias. People believe that others hold the same beliefs and values they do and will into the future. An example is fan psychology. It's the same innate projection bias as being a fan of a particular team or group, which can distort thinking and create bias. We identify with a player or a performer or an organization, and our thinking influences how we see things and then how we behave. This automatically frames how we can view a call by a referee, for example, when we immediately lapse into all or nothing, good or bad thinking. So we project our own belief or value onto someone or something else, and that creates a connection. That's part of what fan psychology is about. Both projection bias as well as fan psychology are in part about belonging, identifying with a group that shares beliefs and values. Another example I've seen when traveling to different parts of the world is how ethnocentric our own views in the United States are. It's striking, and I'm sure many of you have perceived that. So let's look at remedies for bias. A bias involves at times cherry-picking data to confirm our beliefs and specifically ignoring disconfirming data. Facts contrary to beliefs and self-images can be rapidly dismissed or just not engaged. A cue for a bias may exist even without our awareness, in which we may even consciously abhor. And some of those may include racial, gender, cultural, economic biases. A natural gravitation occurs to others who share the same beliefs and generate groupthink or group identity to further the notions and find affirming evidence, and we may not even be consciously aware of how we do this. And groupthink can simply be shared blind spots. We work diligently to preserve our opinions, even though we may not consciously know exactly what they are. So the challenge, then, is to recognize, own, and assess certain aspects of our own stories. This is the first three steps of the roadmap system. And the primary reason these three steps, the first three steps, are a challenge. New information can create unpleasant feelings, and it will generate a natural pushback. New information may demand a change in beliefs, and we naturally tend to seek information that confirm our beliefs rather than disprove them. We don't go around looking for, hey, I'm going to find some ways I'm wrong today. New information may require us to take undesired actions, to leave the security of our known stories and the certainty and predictability of how they'll turn out can feel like lack of control. We're motivated to avoid new information. For example, people aren't afraid of going to the doctor. They're afraid their denial is going to be confronted. It may also be more difficult when the information is hard to understand or interpret, like my very understandable aversion to technology, for example. We first have to realize what we don't know. To know to ask is half the answer. This is difficult because how do you come to know what you don't know? Candid, open feedback from trusted others becomes one way. In executive mentor coaching, you may be familiar with using the 360-degree assessment instrument to have someone self-assess and then get assessments from the immediate orbit on the same questions of that person from a group of people who know that person quite well. I've used it in select instances. This challenges the comfort zone, but it also provides objective and valuable information. Let's look at the hubris syndrome. While confidence is a state of mind that generates remarkable productivity, overconfidence can become a slayer of success. While our minds constantly learn from challenges, internally and externally, the creative and empathic process can be derailed by the experience or even the complacency of power. It's been shown, for example, that the more that we know and the better we become, the more likely we are to overestimate our own ability as well as underestimate the events beyond our control. In one study, CEOs became more confident as they gained merger and acquisition experience, resulting in their overvaluation of subsequent deals. In research from the University of Vienna, investors who obtained significant experience with their specific market then became overconfident and made too risky asset trades. Overtalent and the brain's potentiation of stimulation enhances with sustained success and power. We want to keep it going. Blind certainty can replace active self-reflection. Overconfidence can increase with familiarity, repetition, information, and success. One of the best predictors of overconfidence is power, which enhances with time and experience and can result in stopping to question alternate possibilities. Let's look just briefly at talent. We know from a number of perspectives that talent is not just a genetic gift, but a developmental process. And the real measure of success, the determinant of success, is not innate talent, but deliberate practice. To recognize in advance, for example, sports talent. In socially prominent areas, it's fairly easy. Basketball, baseball in the United States, soccer in England, ice hockey in Canada. Sports make it easy because they're so visible, they're identifiable, they're measurable. Talent in other areas may not be as easily recognized, perhaps not even visible, not transparent. Talent in art, verbal ability, physical and mental skills become challenges to identify and facilitate. Now, there are different innate physical and mental capacities, just as individual personality and learning styles, and the developmental process must be systematically nurtured by discipline and practice in each of these areas. So an optimum model that's evolved from a number of studies about the development of expertise and talent in whatever area you consider. Three aspects. Early diversification. You don't get locked into just doing one thing because you're talented, because you lose development of ability and flexibility in other. Sampling of a number of activities. Exposure for both informed choices and long-term involvement. Deliberate play, for example, of experiencing sport through fun and playful games becomes a solid foundation of intrinsic motivation. Deliberate play establishes a range of cognitive and motor experiences to develop expertise and self-management, as well as a foundation of generalizable skills. Only later, experts suggest, perhaps no earlier than age 13, should a more focused specialization occur. Only by late adolescence have children developed the physical, social, cognitive, emotional, and motor skills to specialize in one sport or endeavor. So, can there be a disadvantage of talent? Talent myths assume a fixed mindset. Why spend time and energy trying to improve if success only comes to people with the right talent or the right genes? That skill and intelligence can be improved is a growth mindset. Talent can be a potential disadvantage because someone with a natural talent may focus only on that and not develop other areas. Those with less skills early on have to work harder to develop them, and this establishes perhaps a systematic way to grow and improve in this process. So a shadow story of talent is that it can mask poor teaching or coaching for a significant period of time, or even until it's time to play a bigger game in some challenging way, intellectually or physically. That's just a sidebar. What does it take for really sustainable success? What do you do after you've reached the top of the mountain, in other words? Because the same work, the same kind of performance to get to the top of the mountain may not be what it takes to sustain that success and even grow it. After their first unprecedentedly successful whirlwind tour of the United States, the first thing the Beatles did when they got back to England was to go to the studio and make their next album. And they made a new album regularly, every 6 months. They didn't bask in their glory, at least too much, or let it derail their plans, at least until 5 or 6 o'clock. They consolidated the success to integrate it with ongoing focus and plans. They pressed their advantage but did not let success derail their plans or hijack their focus. They didn't live their success story. They lived the peak performance story that got them there. Here's an example. A client I'll call Evelyn consulted me because she was having burnout in her career. She'd enjoyed remarkable and rapid success as an actress, moving quickly through local theater productions and national commercials, and a role in a nationally syndicated, fairly well-known series. Her energy brightened a room, including optimism in others, and people were impressed with her imaginative and creative presence at a very young adult age. Being highly intuitive and sensitive allowed her attunement and connection to others, as well as this total immersion in the characters she played and the awards from that. When this sensitivity, let's say that a different way, along with this sensitivity came the resonance with stressful emotions from people around her, resulting in feeling emotionally drained, especially by crowds. She was an intuitive empath, and she took on the negativity or the toxicity from other people as part of this attunement. She described her sensitivity to family and friends, and especially by fans who would approach her, restaurants, public places, wanting her autograph or a selfie with her. She questioned whether her burnout meant that she was not suited for what she was doing, even though she enjoyed the recognition and the stardom, but was passionate about her work. We explored her state of mind after each of these experiences. She described how she had to go home because she was depleted, would feel drained for hours. Even a nap wouldn't restore her energy. Her high degree of creativity and imagination was a natural for her expert work, but off the stage or the set, she needed the necessary buffers and boundaries to regulate her state of mind, resulting in, instead of depletion, in self-preservation and self-regulation. She needed to develop an internal point of reference even more than most individuals because her highly intuitive, empathic style, at times, we could just call it selfless, was eroding the joy from her accomplishments. We focused on her desire to resonate with and nurture others that needed to be developed within herself first, not to abandon herself, to remain grounded in her own experience, loyal to her own needs and ideals, developed a mantra to do that, and she was a very visual person, so the mantra that she had developed as part of our work before she made a major appearance somewhere, like a major talk show, was to envision herself in this cone of white, warm light. And that kept her grounded and centered. And then when she walked on stage or onto the set for the interview or the performance, she was totally grounded and centered and stayed in that experience. So she could preserve her own private space and not intermingle the two if this was applied when she was in a public place. She learned to time, dose, and titrate her exposure to others, to strategically plan and interface with crowds, not to call it selfish when she needed to recognize her own needs, her own ideals. At times, it simply involved reframing that no was a choice of self-care, not something to feel guilty about or disappointing someone. If you frame it as guilt, you're in a very different mindset than if no simply means no. And Carl Menninger said, save guilt for real sin. She structured times each day for brief mindfulness meditation as part of that regulation and self-care. By more effectively grounding and centering yourself, developing a strategy to do that more instantly, cultivating this mindfulness, she developed a greater resilience to the influence and emotion of others. Her career soared even higher. So I want to refer you here to the outline so that we'll have more time for discussion. The ending of the outline is a juxtaposition of experts and amateurs. And here's the simple version of that. This was Bum Phillips, at the time coach to the Oilers, to his, at the time, rookie back, Earl Campbell from the University of Texas, and right before his first pro game. He told Earl, when you get to the end zone, act like you've been there before. In other words, don't go nuts, self-regulate, do what you need to do, celebrate, but then remember who you are. An expert and an amateur are each states of mind. The expert, now in this discussion, is an ideal, a contrast to the amateur. Evolution from amateur to expert is significant. It's a life-changing passage when it occurs. Here are just some highlights of components here, but I'll let you read this on your own so that you have a time where you can really reflect on this and see what may apply to you. Experts continue concentrated, deliberate practice on focused areas to develop with informed feedback. This is the essence of deliberate practice. Amateurs get to a level of good enough and stay there. Experts seek practice and goals that exceed current levels of performance. Amateurs seek to sustain a comfort level without challenging it. Experts understand that there is no predetermined limit of ability. Amateurs may believe there's a fixed reserve of potential. The expert works from love, passion, dedication. Failure is reframed as information to guide proceeding. The amateur may be sidetracked by setback. Failure is validation not to proceed. The expert loves and pursues the game, whatever it is, with total dedication and passion. The amateur pursues maybe as a sideline, as part-time, like a weekend warrior. The expert keeps going no matter what. The amateur may be dissuaded by setback and adversity. Hear how in all of these, this is a matter of focus and framing. These are two essential aspects for what we deal with in coaching with our clients, to look at the entire aspect of focusing and framing and how vital that is to what we do. So I want to let you read the rest yourself so that we can have more, perhaps more time to discuss and to look at what may be of more interest to each of you. I'm going to go off of lecture mode now. I'll ask you to manage the background noise for questions, comments, and things that you'd like to hear more about or just to discuss more, and I'm interested in your perspectives as well. So we're in discussion mode now. What aspects, I want to come back to Carol's case that we began with, but I want to look at anything that you'd like to discuss further. I want to say just basically, these principles of stress mastery and peak performance can apply to any area of business, education, arts, health, human relationships, as well as sports. As we become more self-reflective and better learners, we more effectively write our own stories, whether they're life, career, wellness, relationship, money, performance stories. All are our contributions to ourselves. When we get our story in the best way possible, we're also able to offer the best mentor coaching to our clients to help them develop their optimum performance and engaged elite story in whatever area they decide. So I want to thank you, before we get into discussion, for the opportunity to engage with you through these four seminars. It's been a creative pleasure for me, and the feedback and information I got from you from the beginning and throughout has been very, very useful, and I very much appreciate that. I've enjoyed our collaboration. So what things would you like to discuss and just to talk a bit more about? If there's nothing immediately, then we'll go back to Carol's case. But anything about the material that you'd like to talk a little bit more about, or ask about, or clarify, anyone?
I would be curious. This is Ron.
Hey Ron, how are you?
I'm doing good. Today's session, you were talking about the illusion of control, and you just made a reference to conspiracy theories. I would be interested in hearing a little bit more of expansion of that topic and just discussion.
Okay, if you'll lose the part about conspiracy theory, the idea is how our minds and brains work is to seek closure. We want to seek closure whether or not it's cause and effect, because our brain wants to end dissonance and our mind wants to end uncertainty and trepidation and not knowing. Now, here's a study that was done at Harvard where people were shown for a microsecond, 1/50th of a second, they were shown an image that they weren't aware of. They couldn't pick out the image or the words if they were given a multiple choice, but yet it affected their behavior. For example, in a video or on a screen, when the word elderly was flashed, they could not pick this out. They didn't know or recognize that was flashed, but they would walk a bit more slowly after that for the next 15 to 20 minutes. And this was well documented. There were metrics for this. And similarly, other kinds of things that would affect their behavior or their attitude. When they were asked about this behavior, they said, well, no, that didn't influence me. And then they were shown before and afters to validate that. So they would make up something. They would not attribute it to something they didn't recognize or even believe. They would make up things like saying, well, you know, I've just traveled and I'm probably jet-lagged, or I haven't been sleeping. And they would make up something that would create a closure. A closure that's not cause and effect, but that's what we do. That's how we want to bring an end to anything that's uncertain. That's why we seek people who have the same biases, the same belief systems that we do. It's why we bring closure or seek validation to our own unconscious biases, even the ones that we may consciously abhor. They're still there, and they're still active. So we tend to seek things and to complete the inquiry into new and different things in that way and just move on. So that's kind of what I meant, that we seek explanation even if it's not cause and effect, like that study. Does that make sense, Ron?
Sure. Thank you.
Yeah, and that's where, you know, if something like this may occur with a client, you know, help me understand how you're thinking to come to that conclusion. If somebody goes from A to B to D, we kind of wonder what happened to C, and then we may ask, help me track this. Help me understand how you're thinking about it to come to that decision or that conclusion. Then they may examine it and may become aware with us as we may mutually scrutinize a blind spot or how they may be deceiving themselves in a certain way or omitting certain things, and to see if looking at it a different way is opening in terms of inquiry rather than something that wouldn't bear fruit or that they're not ready for. So we offer an hypothesis or something that we offer a way to look at something or to see if the client is ready to examine. And they say no. So that means that there are some possibilities. One is that we're just wrong and that we're not seeing it right. Or, you know, another is that we're right, but the timing is off. The client's not quite ready to look at it. So it's a matter of dosing, timing, and titrating. And I just said to a client right before this seminar, and I totally believed it, but it helped him conceptualize. I said, you will always know the difference between dosing, timing, and titrating versus procrastination. And that's a belief that someone will live into, but it also helps them to distinguish. Are they bargaining with themselves or putting off something? Or is it something they need and should do, but doing it in a systematic way? Any other aspects of that, Ron, that would help to amplify that you can think of?
Oh, that was good. And a lot of extra explanation. It was very helpful. Thank you.
Okay, super. Other thoughts, questions, or things to look at or explore? Carol, are you ready to do your focus vignette. Can you give me just a sentence or two of framing, and then as we talk, I'll get you to be the client, and I'll be you. tell me just assume that somebody came on late. Just frame it within two or three sentences so that we have an appreciation of where you and where this client are. Just a succinct overview.
A succinct overview. First engagement was really to work on externalities and her response to people outside of her, how she regulated her emotions. Second coaching engagement is to really work on her fears that she's internalizing and that might be limiting her ability to move toward peak performance.
Okay.
Did you help?
I think so. It helps me get an appreciation. Did you and she remain at this level of abstraction?
No. We did
okay,
not.
That's a summary artifact. Okay, all
right. Yes, exactly. Right.
Okay. All right. You're her. I'm you.
Yeah.
You just called me.
Yeah.
What would you like us to focus on specifically right now?
Well, you know, I had my race this weekend, and I didn't place where I thought I should have. And, you know, I don't know. I'm really disgusted and frustrated. And I don't know. I'm even thinking maybe this is not something I want to do.
Okay. Where would you like us to get to at the end of a brief discussion about this specific agenda?
Well, you know, I want to be able to figure out whether or not, you know, these are the people that I'm working with that, you know, that what I can do to find some other people to work with.
Okay, so you've already identified it as the question about the other people, not about the optimization of your performance or your practice. Can you say in just a sentence how you came to that specific conclusion, that it's about the other people, not about your practice or your performance? Just in a single sentence.
Well, I make good choices, and you know, I'm a 2-time past champion, and I just want to, you know, I think I'm the marketable piece of this, and I'm just going to have to focus on me.
Okay. What was different in this performance that you noticed that was different than your championship performances? As specific as you can be.
Yeah, well, first of all, I was driving, the driver I was with was a Fiari driver, and we had a good synergy, and it worked. And we were really a great team together.
And that was in your best performances?
Yes.
So for you, what was different in your experience this time?
Well, you know, I am using some of the things that we discussed. You know, I do my 5-minute creative visualization in the morning, my meditative practice. I do my pep talks. I say things, you know, I have value, I'm good enough, new lap, new opportunity. But, you know, somehow when I'm in the car driving, I get thrown off. And you know, I keep saying concentrate, you know, practice.
Okay, I want to stop you to focus on something you said, because you said it in a way as if you're the passive recipient of some process that you get thrown off. If you look at that in an active way, how do you stop yourself from that performance flow?
Well, in our last session, I came up with that mantra that I told you, that I say, new lap, new opportunity. So whenever I find myself going in that space, that's what I say to myself, new lap, new opportunity.
Okay. So how did you, what you call getting thrown off, what happened that was different that you can learn from to stay in a performance flow?
Well, I mean, there, Well, as far as it goes for me, I'm a good driver, and I make good decisions, and you know, and I have to make good decisions because when I'm in the car, you know, anything could go wrong. There are a lot of things I can't control, but there are a lot in the car I can't control. But and I don't know, just for some reason, my timing is just not there.
Okay, I want to go back to the question and get you to focus specifically on the instant that you lost that positive focus and flow and began a negative self-talk. What was the immediate experience that prompted that, the cue or the trigger that created that state change for you?
Well, while I was in the car, I can't think, well, the one thing that's always in the back of my head is, you know, I don't want to be dropped. You know, I need to finish, and I need to finish, you know, with a good time. Otherwise, I'm afraid that I'm not going to be, you know, picked as one of the drivers.
Okay, I want to interrupt you here. I have a suggestion, but my first observation is something already moved you from playing to win to playing not to lose. I don't want to be dropped is a negative focus, and our brains always follow our focus. So that focus is guaranteed to derail you. So are you willing to do an exercise with me? Or to do this? Okay. Here's what I would suggest. I would suggest that in the next day or two or three, whenever you can carve out an appointment with yourself for 30 minutes at least, maybe 40, 45 minutes, to schedule an appointment with yourself with no interruption, no telephone, no text, nothing that's in, and get really grounded and centered, and look as an observer at any emotional trigger that gets you off center or out of flow, the immediate emotional trigger that does that. Now, that may be, you know, a look in somebody's eyes. It may be a particular thought. And write down each of those emotional triggers as an observer, not to get re-triggered and in that state. And then look for each trigger at, remember the neural conditioning chart, column 2, the usual response. In that column are all the things that you may think of as causes, but it's the negative self-talk, the doubt, the playing to not to lose, all the things that are the result of that state change. That time capsule will never change. They're always going to be there. So you can't address any of those because you're already in a time capsule. The key is to recognize the trigger and the state change, the content of that, so that you can, as quickly as possible, refocus and reframe to get grounded and centered and to have an ideal behavior. So a second appointment with yourself would be to work on a specific mantra, a cue, a focus, a physiology for each of the, and it may be the same for everyone, every one of those triggers, but a mantra and then a specific ideal behavior for each emotional trigger. So instead of getting in negative self-talk or wondering, then you're immediately grounded and centered and into that ideal behavior. It may be the thought, whatever the performance flow is, you'll know way better than I would where you want to get to and how to sustain that. Now, in certain situations, you may need to do that mantra in a repeated way. What do you think about that exercise and doing that and talking about it next time to look at what we can learn from that?
Well, I think that's a really good idea. It's like we talked about last week. I think that I'm going to have to, you know, get to a place where I make the fear of losing smaller than the joy and excitement of winning.
I think it's going to work in a different way. I think it's by focusing on playing to win that you're going to win, and you're going to not engage the playing not to win or playing not to lose. So Here's how we're wired for that. Our two most basic motivations as human beings is to seek pleasure and avoid pain. There's some pain that you're avoiding in playing not to lose. So when you refocus on the pleasure and on the positive, that redirects the energy field of your brain and the focus of your mind to pursue that. So there's not a possibility. It's like the example we used earlier about the BMW racing school and focusing on where the next immediate place you're going is, not on what you want to avoid, because you'll hit it every time. So if you find yourself in any way playing not to lose, then recognize that as an error message from your brain and reframe it to what you want to do. Refocus on exactly the next step. That's what we've talked about in terms of neuroplasticity, those three steps. Recognize and reframe and refocus. Recognize it as an error message from your brain to focus on what you may want to avoid or losing or anything negative. Reframe it to what you want to do, what's next, and then focus on that. Refocus. That'll rewire your brain. Now, let's stop here. I'm not submitting. I'm not submitting this as an example of mentor coaching. I'm submitting it as an example of me talking to you, Carol, acting like you're your client, because this is way more information and way more directive than I would ever think about. It's not too far, but it's different. So I'm not suggesting that you do mentor coaching like this, but it's something, you know, I might do it pressed, like in a demo. Now, what are your thoughts as you experienced your client in being her? What was your thought?
My thoughts were, first of all, thank you for the session, because that's all the questions, everything that you said, that's exactly the strategy I'm using. So really what I wanted was sort of an affirmation that, yeah, you're on track.
Okay.
You know, but like, yes, you're doing these things, you know, recognize the triggers, you know, reframe those triggers, and then refocus up to the new behavior that you want to see rather than focus on the old behavior. So the same kinds of feedback that you provided to me was what I was providing to the client. But I just wanted to hear you, how you would handle that kind of that, and literally that's the kind of discussion that's going on.
You'll find an opportunity for, and something that's not so compressed, is a way to empathically resonate with your client about how frustrating maybe the return to an old way of doing things, or to focusing on playing not to lose, can be, or how different and uncomfortable it is to do something new or and different and not know exactly what the outcome's going to be, and keep trying even though it's uncomfortable or there's an uncertainty, because that's part of a growth mindset, to look at what's next, to tolerate the discomfort of doing something new and different and sticking with it and repeating it until it becomes the default mode. But that takes a while. That's why it's a hard work miracle. That's why that neural conditioning chart, if you do that enough, you move from what is an emotional trigger to automatically wiring that ideal behavior. And that becomes a neural conditioning. That becomes new wiring. And what you'll find also with the mantra is, after you do it enough, a single word or a single gesture will be enough to induce instantly that entire state of being grounded and centered. You don't have to repeat it every time, all three components. You do it enough, you get the cue rings, or the focus phrase. And remember to make it really short and also really relevant. You remember we talked about, you know, a golfer may use a different focus phrase on a putt where it needs to be relaxed and smooth, as on the other end of the spectrum, in terms of focus phrases for golfers, for a drive where it needs to be solid and powerful. So the state can be instantly booted up by a gesture, a focus phrase, or something that you've moved to a hardwiring in and of itself. So we'll take another 2 or 3 minutes. Are there, and thank you very much, Carol, for doing this.
Well, thank you. Thank you. That was great.
Okay, super. I appreciate that. Other questions, thoughts, or comments from anyone? Anything we didn't cover that you still have questions or comments about, or any other answers to that initial question about what's the most important thing you're taking away, and is there anything we didn't talk about that you wanted to, either one or both? What's the most important thing you're taking away?
The crowd is silent.
Yes? Ron, you got anything?
I do.
How did I know that? Go ahead.
Well, I spoke earlier, so I was giving others the chance to say something, but...
You've been nice enough. Go ahead.
Okay. And I was actually going to even send you a follow-up note here, but I have myself, I've done a much better mastery of managing state of mind. And I also have the ability, I think the confidence mentality and able to sustain that. I think that it is a mode of operation that's key. And I will continue to be focused on that. So those are some key takeaways.
Terrific. Okay.
I am confident that I can operate more successfully from a confidence mindset. So there you go. You have a double expression there, but also engaging in a mental toughness to fight the self-bargaining. I think that's definitely a key takeaway. And so these are personal things, but I can also reflect that in the coaching that I do and will do to help other individuals identify those same behaviors and find ways to manage that.
Super. Okay. Thank you very much. That's great. Who else? Important takeaway or question remaining? Either one. Oh, I've gotten a couple of questions, and I didn't want to really talk about it during this seminar series, but I will send each of you an invitation and a kind of an overview of the NeuroMentor Institute for Peak Performance. The next cohort I'm doing will be for mentor coaches, and that's something that I'll send you an invitation for this first cohort, or this next cohort that will be just for mentor coaches, not for athletic coaches. So you'll get something about that in the mail with an invitation, so that'll be an opportunity. But I don't want to talk about that now, because I want to talk about this experience and bringing a closure to that. And if there's anything else that you'd like to talk about, let's take a minute and do it. Anything else that you think about or want to say or are taking away? Well, thank you all very much. It's been a privilege. I've enjoyed it totally. I really appreciate the feedback, the questions, and it's been a total privilege and very stimulating to do this with you guys. Thanks so much. And if I can be of help to you in any way, let me know. I hope we're not done crossing paths. See you, and thanks again. Bye now.
Thanks, Dave. Thank
Absolutely.
You.
Thank you.
See you guys.
Bye.
Bye.
See you.